That was Pete Seeger singing John Brown's Body. John Brown was born on this day in 1800. We were about to have a conversation with Dr. Greg Grandin, who, of course, was nominated for a Pulitzer for Voigtlandia. He's written this new book, a relatively new book, coming out called The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. He's a professor of history at NYU. And Greg Grandin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this and this book, by the way, folks, we're about to talk about is a book that is really deals with the hidden intricacies about our society, America and the West, how we're defined by slavery. And it's dialectically opposite of freedom and liberty and built around this book, Benito Sereno, that many people have not read by Herman Melville. But this tale of the slave revolt and what you discover about it, because you had been teaching this book in your class, is that right? Because you teach Spanish.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Herman Melville wrote this really wonderful novella, amazing novella in 1855 called Benito Sereno. And it's all about a North American New England sea captain who spends all day on board a Spanish-American ship, slave ship, and he can't see that the slaves were actually in charge, that they were running things. And what's remarkable, they had revolted a few weeks earlier, seized the ship, killed most of the Spaniards, and then when they ran into this North American ship, they came up with this plan that they would let him board and they would pretend to be slaves, suss out the situation. They could have fought or they could have fled, but instead they opted to pretend to be slaves. It's a fascinating story Melville tells. He wrote it a few years after Moby Dick and a few years before the coming of the American Civil War. And it turns out that the whole thing is true. And Melville got it from the memoirs of the real Amasa Delano, the name of the New England captain who this happened to. And Melville just basically fictionalized it. He rewrote it into this novella. And it's a really haunting story because it's all told through the point of view of Amasa Delano. Readers don't know that the slaves are in charge until Melville reveals them to be in charge 2/3 into the story. And I just started researching it. I read the memoir in which Melville got the event from, learned of the event, and I began to research it, and then I began to try to recreate the history of the slave voyage and the revolt, and the story itself is what I write about in The Empire of Necessity.
And what you've done also is you brought to life in terms of your book the characters Babu and Maury, who were blended into one in Melville's book, but were really in most of the texts around this were kind of lost in terms of who they were, their journey, their possible journey, their thinking, who they might have been, which is what you try to bring to life.
Yeah, I mean, in Melville's story, they're really ciphers, the West Africans who stage the deception, who, you know, revolt, seize the ship and stage the deception. You don't really know anything about them. But it turns out that their backstory of how they got into the Pacific, and all of these events happened in the South Pacific, far from where we think of as the heartland of American slavery and the plantation societies of the Caribbean or Brazil or Southern United States. So how they got into the Pacific and how what Amasa Delano was doing in the Pacific is really the heart of my book. My book basically tells two stories. One, it tracks the West Africans out of West Africa across the Atlantic and into Montevideo and Buenos Aires and southern South America. But then across the Americas, they were marched across the Pampas, or across the American continent, and over the Andes and into the South Pacific. And then the other story my book tells is Amasa Delano out of New England and into the South Pacific as a sealer, and then the kind of explosive encounter of these two narrative arcs.
And to me, the companies let's explore. As soon as you said that, I think this to open some territory here that really has not been opened by many. I mean, when we hear of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, we think of the West Indies, we think of Brazil, we think of the United States of America, obviously. But what we don't think about, and only recently have I seen some articles about it, is Argentina, is Uruguay, is Peru, is Chile, are these countries that we look as quote-unquote white.
Yeah, all of South America, Spanish America and Portuguese America. I mean, that's really where the institution of slavery started in the 1500s, in the Caribbean, but then in Colombia, what's now Colombia, and then Venezuela and Spanish South America, and then into the back into the Caribbean and into the United States. What we think of as of slavery, we often think of the 12 years of slave, the explosion of slavery that happened after 1812 in the United States with the invention of the cotton gin and the rising demand for cotton and the push into the Mississippi and into East Texas. My book tries to step back and look at the institution of slavery in its much more broader context.
But we think of those countries as, you know what I'm saying, Argentina and Uruguay, many of those countries are not thought of either as white or with native people. And what you're opening is a context of that these were great slave ports and that this trek you have taken
from the Pampas. I mean, Buenos Aires and Montevideo were 30% African American. I mean, 30% of the population were enslaved Africans or African Americans. It was built on slave labor, and historians are just beginning to acknowledge that.
And so, I mean, I think that's an eye-opening part of this book for many people who would read it or have read it, and the trek that Babo Amore took these other slaves across from Argentina over the Andes Mountains to the Pacific, to Peru. I mean, that's something we also don't think about as a slave journey.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, when we think of the Atlantic voyage, we think of the Middle Passage. Most enslaved people spent their lives fairly close to the Atlantic, on slave islands or in slave plantations on Piedmont and Tidewater area of Virginia, and in Bahia and Brazil, or Cartagena in Colombia, the sugar plantations of Venezuela. But this story opens up to a much broader history in the sense that this particular group of enslaved West Africans endured something of a second Middle Passage. They came into Montevideo as seized goods. They were seized by a French pirate and brought into Montevideo and then sold to Spanish American merchants. And then they were marched across the Pampas. That journey was just as long as the first Middle Passage. And then they were forced up the Andes. The Andes are the second highest mountain range in the world and the highest in the Americas. And it was quite a dramatic ordeal that they were compelled to make.
You know, one of the things I find so interesting about how you kind of went into the lives of these human beings, the Africans as well as the African Americans as well as the whites, is getting into the something that kind of was an obsession in that era we don't know about, which was wrestling with the unconscious, wrestling with human feeling, wrestling with humanity, that actually came out many times. That world was obsessed with the notions of slavery and liberty and freedom.
Yeah, and I try to kind of look at the relationship, how those ideals are formed in relationship to the other. Obviously, notions of freedom and slavery existed for a long time, but it really was during the Age of Revolution in the 1770s, 1780s, 1790s. That they began the idea of individual freedom and individual autonomy and integrity, and the idea of a person in that has inherent rights and autonomy and a moral conscience, began to democratize throughout society, began to generalize. In the past, that quality of an autonomous man was really the property of a very privileged few, but it's starting in the 1760s, 1770s, 1780s, the Age of Revolution, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, the Spanish-American Revolution, these ideas begin to generalize and across the population. And it was also at the same time that the institution of slavery began to deepen. Slavery obviously existed for hundreds of years prior to the Age of Revolution, but it really was starting in the 1770s, that the Spanish-American merchants began to demand greater and greater what they called, very frankly, free trade in blacks. The liberalization, the privatization, the deregulation of a very tightly controlled mercantile economy was very much bound up in the extension of slavery. What was deregulated, what was privatized, and what was largely the institution of slavery. Prior to that, only a few select cities in Spanish America had the right to bring in slaves. Only a few monopoly countries or companies had the right to import slaves. Taxes and tariffs were very high. But Spanish Crown began to deregulate the institution, and it was a kind of free-for-all. You know, it's a bit of an abstraction to say that the age of liberty and the age of slavery were one and the same thing, but there's some numbers that provide a very graphic illustration of what I mean by that. Historians estimate that about 12.5 million Africans were taken out of the continent and brought to the Americas between the 1500s and the end of slavery in the middle of the 19th century. Of those 12.5 million people, more than half came after July 4th, 1776. So in a very real way, the material way and emotional way, what we think of as freedom and liberty, was very much tied in with the expansion and explosion of slavery.
You have this great quote in the beginning of the book from the philosopher Hegel: "So much from slavery as through slavery that humanity was emancipated."
Yeah, it is a really wonderful quote, and I try to kind of grapple with what, you know, Hegel has that wonderful allegory of the master slave, and how the master thinks of himself as a truly independent being, but he gradually comes to realize that his being and his whole existence is dependent on the recognition, not just the physical labor of the slave, but the recognition of the slave. And at the same time, the slave gradually grows aware of this dependence. And Hegel imagines this kind of process of interdependence and awareness of independence as an important step forward in the achievement of freedom, you know, progress. And I kind of use that when Hegel came up with that allegory, more or less around the same time that this remarkable story of deception and revolt in the Pacific was taking place. So I used it to think a little bit about what was going on these ships in the South Pacific. That is the setup of my book.
And I'm going to get right to that, what happened in the South Pacific, but I wanted to pick up on something you were alluding to a moment ago and that you kind of really delve into. We talked for a second before we went on the air together about how many people are now once again talking about the deep connections between slavery and capitalism, that the world we have today would not have existed without slavery in the West. But one of the things you make really clear in there, that this was, as you were talking about what happened with the Spanish Crown, this was in some ways the beginning of the free market revolution, the beginning of the insurance and credit and shipping industries that were created because of slavery.
Yeah, I mean, historians have made the argument about the importance of slavery to capitalism for decades, at least since Eric Williams, who was the prime minister of Trinidad and Tobago. He wrote this wonderful book called Capitalism and Slavery in 1944.
Yes, right.
But, Williams' thesis tend to focus more very, very precisely on the profits that slavery made and how it went into fuel the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain. But historians now, this generation of historians, this is a new generation of historians that are looking at, you know, the much more diffuse and diverse ways in which slavery contributed to the creation of our modern world. I mean, insurance companies, for some of the first policies that they underwrote were on slave lives and slave ships. And it's not just that, and the point isn't just that they made profits, these companies made profits, is that they, you know, some of the basic calculations of how you figure out the value of a life, or you figure out how you calculate, the kind of wear and tear on a life over time comes out of the institution of slavery. Historians have looked at how large-scale plantations in the South were really these kind of models of managing labor on a large scale, double entry bookkeeping, and whatnot. Obviously, the energy and technology that went into the steamboats on the Mississippi River and the Mississippi River as a main artery of the slave trade, the technological innovations of that, the ways in which profit from Southern slavery underwrote all sorts of economic activities in the North, the way the North was able to develop its so-called comparative advantage, salting fish, making textiles, by selling those goods to Southern plantations and plantations in the Caribbean. But then even beyond economics, there's ways in which slavery shaped the institution and knowledge of that go into medicine, for instance. Slave ships, we know of them as floating tombs, but they were also floating laboratories. Mm-hmm. They gave doctors and scientists an opportunity to study the course of disease in fairly controlled circumstances. If a slave ship showed up in a port in Baltimore or Montevideo and say there was 70% mortality, they could interview people and find out how the symptoms presented themselves and speculate and theorize on the best way to contain certain diseases. Blindness, for instance, was a big disease that struck slave ships, trachoma. And what we know about trachoma as a disease now largely comes out of the practice of slavery. So there's all sorts of ways, insurance and medicine, philosophy, religion, that slavery was instrumental in shaping.
You know, one of the things I want to tell you, it's not like diversion, because I think it's the heart of the book. Before we talk about Amasa Delano and Samuel Delano and Melville and Sereno, because I want to get to them, but I want to you unfolded another piece of history here that we don't wrestle with very much, and one that comes out of both Babo Amori, who led the revolt on the slave ship, on the ship, the trial that the book Benito Sereno was based on. And to develop them as human beings. But one of the things you talked about in that first was Islam and the power of Islam in the slave among slaves, among who they were, where they came from. As a quick digression, I actually used – you taught me something in this book, a lot of things, but about Uthman Danfodio, that I actually used an argument about the what's happening in Nigeria today, looking at the history of what Islam was really like in West Africa, but which I appreciate. Thank you for – but this is an amazing piece of our history that, again, we do not consider.
Yeah, historians don't really know how many enslaved Africans were Muslim, but some estimate as many as 10%. They could only guess based on the numbers of captives taken out of certain regions where Islam predominated. So in West Africa, in Senegambian region, and then into the Niger Delta, there were communities there that where Islam had come down centuries before the Europeans came and slavery was instituted, and historians, some estimate as many as 10%. The largest urban slave revolt in the Americas was led by Muslims in Bahia in Brazil in 1835, and they rose. I mean, Bahia Islam was very visible among slave communities. There were mosques. Men wore white linen clothing. They wrote out the Quran. And the day that they chose to start the revolt in 1835 was the holiest day of Ramadan, the night of power, the day that the Archangel Gabriel supposedly gave some of the first verses of the Quran to Muhammad. And interestingly enough, Babo Mori and the leaders of this West African this revolt on board this slave ship in the South Pacific that starts off my book and that inspired Herman Melville, they were also identified as Muslim. Around this time, around 1803, 1804, West Africa was embroiled in a series of religious wars among Muslim communities, non-Muslim communities, and apostate Muslim communities. So there might be some Orthodox Islamic movement or Sufi Islam or Orthodox movement rising up against a kind of more urban Muslim community or polity that they considered to be heretical or lax in their teaching. There was a lot of warfare between Muslims and non-Muslims, and that generated a lot of the captives that fed into the slave trade. into the Atlantic slave trade. And this was around the time that these West Africans were taken out of West Africa and brought to the Americas.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
On the way to break, we're hearing I Fought the Law by the Crickets. So the song was written by Sonny Curtis, who was born this day in 1937. Happy birthday, Billy Joel, born this day in 1949, and singing We Didn't Start the Fire for us. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Greg Grandin, who, of course, was nominated for a Pulitzer for Voigtlandia. He's written this new book, a relatively new book, coming out called The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. He's a professor of history at NYU, and you make a very strong argument that, in part, many of the slave revolts being led by people of Muslim faith because I think, as you put it, they were the ones who understood the notions of insurgency, understood they were literate, they spoke and read Arabic and other languages. So they became kind of the natural leaders of some of the resistance to slavery once they were captured.
Yeah, the Spanish authorities were very clear that the problem was they were buying their slaves from Portuguese, from the French, from the British, so they didn't really know where they came from, and they couldn't actually enforce this prohibition. But Spanish authorities tried to prohibit the importation of Muslim slaves, largely because they saw Islam as a threat in a number of ways. It was a religion that was very similar to Christianity, a belief in a universal God with a prophetic sense of justice and redemption, a religion that had a strong tradition of theology, a religion that also had a strong spirit of resistance and emphasis on human dignity. All of these were a dangerous mix that Spaniards clearly recognized. But the problem was that they couldn't actually enforce that prohibition because they brought their slaves from whoever brought them in. And so one of the things that I tried to emphasize in this book was, there's a lot of scholarship that focuses on the kind of more pastoral or oral or peasant sources of African American strength and resistance, kind of stories told around the campfire about the trickster who's able to gull the slave master or the masters in different ways. And all of that scholarship is incredibly valuable. But what I was trying to think about was, well, if these West Africans were literate, and they were, because they were identified in Spanish documents as literate, what might be other sources of their resistance? And not just the resistance, what allowed them to pull off this deception? We didn't really talk about this earlier, but the deception that they managed to pull off was really quite remarkable. I mean, they had already been drifting in the South Pacific for 50 days. They were starving. They were thirsty. Two women died of hunger and thirst. Two children died of dehydration. One could imagine that when they came upon Amasa Delano's ship, they would have done anything to get food and water. They would have fought. They would have surrendered. But instead, they managed to summon up this remarkable inner resources and strength and reassume the role of slaves or the performance of slaves. And that was just find that a kind of remarkable pantomime. And it was successful. For 9 hours, they managed to convince a fairly experienced mariner who had sailed around the world 3 times that what he was witnessing was the workings of a distressed but otherwise normal Spanish-American slave ship.
That's amazing. I mean, I just see this actual story in a very different way. I think is really important. And you tell the tale of the San Juan Nepomuceno.
Yes, that's another revolt that took place.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason and the importance of that story to my book is that revolt was also led by Muslims. It happened a few years prior to the main revolt that I talk about. And the Spanish authorities identified them as Muslims and linked it to the revolt that I write about, and 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 say explicitly that we have to stop importing Muslim slaves because of the perverse ideas that they bring. But the revolt, I mean, it must be one of the greatest escapes in history. I mean, the revolt I write about winds up suppressed, and it's not the liberation and freedom doesn't happen for these West Africans.
But on
San Juan Nepomuceno, this small other revolt that I talk about in one chapter, you know, when historians talk about slave ship revolts, most of them occur close to shore, and what might or might not be a successful revolt is, you know, the ship kind of runs aground and maybe they manage to make it to shore. I don't know of any slave ship revolt that actually managed to reverse the Middle Passage, but in this particular case, they did. They had left Montevideo. They were heading around. They were heading to the Cape of Africa, Cape Horn around South America into the Pacific when they rose up, and then after 3 months sailing in the Pacific, sailing in the Atlantic, and getting into three skirmishes with other ships and a fort in the Cape Verde Islands, they managed to make it to Senegal, and they claim their freedom. It really is this remarkable event.
Now, that's an amazing story. You talk about others like the Amistad and things in the book as well, and the importance of that in legal history and more. But this particular revolt is something I think, again, most people have never heard about. That's why I wanted to raise it in the course of the conversation. But going back to the original book that inspired you with this, And looking at people like Amasa and Sam Delano and also Sereno, and how you kind of how you take these three characters, the man who owned the slave ship trial that Babo and the West Africans took over to hit the brother Sam of and Amasa, who were the New Englanders who came and rescued the boaters. I mean, and that you represent them as different aspects of capitalism, though, different aspects of the free market culture, different aspects of who we've become.
Well, what I've tried to do was, it's always the trick of history, right? When you're writing about individuals, you have to be able to capture their integrity and uniqueness, and without reducing them to some kind of stereotype, and at the other hand, they for them to be interesting and compelling, they do have to kind of represent some larger historical moment, and it's that tension that's hard to work, and it's worked out. And you know, Amasa Delano is very much a new man of the American Revolution. He embodies all of the optimism of the American Revolution, but also its limitations. He was born in a town, Duxbury, that early on embraced a very kind of radical vision of human nature, the early kind of seedbed of what would later become called Unitarianism, the idea that human beings were perfectible, that they could use their reason, they can use their virtue, they can use their will in order to tame their passions and their appetites, and if they could self-govern themselves, then they can, if they can govern their inner psyche, then they can govern themselves politically, and that's the heart of republicanism, and republicanism back then, what I'm talking about.
Right. And, 19th century republicanism.
And what made the American Revolution so radical. But then he goes abroad and he can't realize the dream. He can't fulfill the promise. It's constantly just out of reach. And then he gets caught up in the institutions of slavery and environmental destruction. He's a sealer in the South Pacific, and so he represents a certain kind of resource extraction. Sealing is this very brutal industry that was one of the United States' first experience with boom and bust resource extraction beyond its borders. And Amasa Delano was there for the boom, and he did quite well, but he was also there for the bust. It was in that context of ecological exhaustion, the disappearance of seals, and his own need to maintain labor discipline over his men in this context of ecological crisis, that he runs into the trial and this history and this ship that embodies South American, Spanish American slavery. And so I use that event to kind of capture the intersection of the violence of slavery and the violence of sealing.
Which I find interesting too. I mean, because this is. I mean, especially Amasa is like this character who pushes what has to be done in capitalism, almost even though he has a consciousness, doesn't accept it, ignores it, because he has to do what he thinks he needs to do, whether it's the destruction of the seals or the destruction of slavery that he knows is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's yes, he is a republic. He's opposed to slavery. He's opposed to all forms of arbitrary power, and he does get caught up, and he winds up participating in the maintenance of slavery, and he winds up profiting over slavery. What I try to do is show that was less of a kind of moral failing, which it was obviously. But it was driven by this larger context of ecological pressure, as a way of kind of showing the larger determinants or the larger, structural forces at work in reproducing slavery.
I mean, so partially what you're telling us, I mean, just in the last few minutes we have together, I mean, one of the things that you seem to really explore here, some of the subtext and sometimes the text itself, is that, many people have kind of written about, or writing about, I should say, once again, the underpinnings, the capitalism that we know it is created by slavery. I mean, this whole question of reparations, which I'm going to ask you about in a moment, is tied into that. But you're also, this book is also positing in a very powerful way, is that our notions of liberty and freedom are linked and wrapped up with slavery. It was hard for us, if we really looked at our history and looked at ourselves, to separate them.
Yeah, it would be impossible. Amasa Delano, I think, represents a different kind of racism. The racism that created slavery was justified in doctrine, of religious doctrine and philosophy. I think the kind of racism that emerges with the expansion of free trade, with the rise of the age of liberty, and the kind of generalization of these notions of individual rights and freedom, was a different kind of racism. It was more based less on doctrine and less on philosophy, and more on the psychic need to define one's freedom in relationship to another person's slavery. I think there's a way in which the story of Amasa Delano obliquely and subtly kind of casts light on the conundrum today, why so much of our political culture in the United States can't seem to escape the rhetoric of racism and slavery. That when, setting aside the motives of individual conservatives or Tea Partiers, but it's almost a kind of compulsion to reference their politics in terms of the language of the Civil War in terms of nullification. Mm-hmm. And talking about it, when Rand Paul says that the right to believe in the right to health care is like believing in slavery and the right to enslave. I think there's a logic. I mean, no matter how crazy that sounds, I think there is a historical logic to that sentiment. I think today's cult of individual supremacy that drives so much of America's political culture today is very much rooted in a cult of white supremacy, setting aside the motives of any of one person, Clive and Bundy, who can't but sputter out but talking about the Negro when he's talking about defending his land. I think there's a way in which, or not even his land, the government's land. I think there's a way in which that notion of rights, of individual rights, that notion of individual liberty, that notion of individual supremacy is very much rooted in a history of chattel slavery in the United States. And it's that recognition that a refusal to recognize that relationship, which allows it to be perpetuated and inescapable.
I think that at that point here, I mean, that to me is kind of central to where this book takes us today. If you look at history and think about where we are now and the things you've written in this book, which I just, I learned so much reading this book about our history that I was not aware of, and I love history. And, you know, how slavery was central to the establishment of things like finance, insurance, and real estate industry in America, things that dominate our economy today. But you can kind of push that in some senses into the notion of reparations that what we are arguing about in America today has become an argument again when you look at that compared to the reparations given to slave-owning families.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, the question of reparations, I mean, setting aside whether all of the technical questions about reparations and how it would be calculated and who would it be distributed to, I think they do tend to focus more on the idea of wages or the labor or compensating for the labor that went into the creation of America, the unpaid labor that was slavery. And I think to some degree that actually is quite a conservative position, that actually doesn't capture the fullness of the contribution that slavery made. I mean, I don't know how one would calculate the value of the intellectual property that was created in, say, the realm of medicine or the realm of law or finance. Like, how would you calculate that? But I think that in some ways the debate needs to be expanded. It's not just about back wages. It's about all of these other things that slavery created.
So tell me what, I'm curious, as you opened these doors for yourself, you traveled to most of the countries you talked about, Uruguay and Chile and throughout Latin America to kind of research what you found, the story. I'm curious, what were the kind of most significant things that you walked away with you didn't expect in this book, what you learned from it? I mean, we all have our theories about slavery and capitalism and knowledge of what that means, and we're talking about it, but what was it that kind of sparked you as you made this journey?
Well, just, again, realizing the centrality of slavery in the creation of the West. You know, all of these cities that I traveled to, Seville and London and Buenos Aires and Montevideo and Lima and in Senegal, I went to Dakar and St. Louis. Just you begin to kind of see slavery in everything, right? The ornate architecture, the food, the we just really do see the wealth. And you could do a kind of tour of the world based on slave routes and realize the centrality of slavery in creating the opulence of the world that we live in. The other thing that was interesting we talked about was the role of Islam in American
Yes.
slavery, which was definitely a kind of eye opener.
I mean, I think that's a piece of scholarship that still that you've helped open the door to. I think, and even though you name some books in here that you studied,
yeah,
and read.
I mean, historians and scholars have looked into this deeply, but there is a way in which it kind of gets not repressed, but not dealt with. I mean, you know, Roots. I mean, going back to Alex Haley, Roots. You know, Kunta Kinte. I mean, it's clear in that book and even in the TV series that Kunta Kinte is Muslim. You know, he's
right.
So there is a way, even in popular culture, it's present, but then it never quite takes hold.
And first of all, I'm going to thank you, Greg Randon, for spending this time with us today, The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. And as we explore this whole notion of our history and present, I hope you'll join us for some conversations with other people as we kind of figure out where we've been and where we're going and who we are.
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate you taking time with us. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Have a nice day.
Thank you.